This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the fourth week of May, and this week, the U.S. Senate has been furiously working toward a bipartisan compromise on spending to advance high-tech research and compete with China. It's been a freewheeling, chaotic, open process, and as we tape Friday morning, it appears we're actually going to get a sausage out of this sausage-making process. Although Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin had tied things up and pushed discussions further out into Friday, as the Senate sort of itches to leave and go home on recess. Negotiations over the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act also look like they're productive, with lawmakers hoping to reach a deal that they can pass later in June when they come back from that recess. But some other negotiations look less productive. Republicans made another counteroffer on an infrastructure package, but the parties are even far apart than they look like. President Biden has cut his proposal from $2.3 trillion over 8 years to $1.7 trillion. Republicans are proposing a bit over $900 billion, but most of that money is money the government already would be spending on infrastructure. So the new spending in the Republican proposal is only about a quarter of $1 trillion over 8 years, which is obviously not trivial, but it's about a seventh of what Biden wants. They also disagree about what exactly infrastructure is, and therefore what kinds of projects should go into this package. Republicans also appear on track to block the establishment of a bipartisan commission to investigate the January 6th Capitol riot. To talk about that, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rachel Bovard, Senior Policy Director at the Conservative Partnership Institute on the right. Hello, Rachel.
Hi there.
And on the left, Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. Hello, Liz.
Hi, Josh.
We also have a special guest today who's a friend of the show we haven't had here in a while. I want to welcome back David Frum, staff writer at The Atlantic, author and former speechwriter for former President George W. Bush. Hello, David.
Hey, what a pleasure to join you.
So, David, there are congressional committees with investigative power that can look into the riot. The Department of Justice is conducting the investigations that underlie hundreds of prosecutions that are stemming from the riot. What's the particular purpose that a bipartisan commission would serve here?
Well, this is why it's so difficult, because the purpose of a congressional commission is to look into wrongdoing inside Congress. Everyone seems to agree that people who actually broke into the building and attacked officers should be investigated and, if convicted, punished. The question is, did anyone on the inside, was anyone there involved? I mean, Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz, what was their role? And what was the role of the president? These are fundamentally political questions without legal liability. One of the ways that we have gone wrong so often during the Trump years is that we try to legalize things. And again through the Trump years, what we discovered was that the worst acts were not crimes. They were abuses of authority. They were corrupt acts that were not other, that are not normally prohibited exactly in criminal law. And because we try to find a prosecutable offense, we miss the real danger to the country. That's the issue in January 6th, and that's why the Republicans don't want to do it, because the answers to that question don't implicate some government employee. They don't implicate the system in general. They implicate particular individuals with high ranks in the Republican Party.
Rachel, do you think that's a fair characterization?
I don't, because we do have accountability in the political process, and it's called elections. And if we take our politics and begin to punish them with procedures that are sort of extra democratic, I think we've moved into a new threshold of what self-government actually means. And I would point out, too, that it's not as though there is no investigation going on. I think at this point, Congress has had close to 10 hearings on this topic, and Democrats that are in charge of both the House and the Senate have indicated they're going to have more. So I do think that there is investigation going on. I do think people are being hauled before Congress to look into this question. And the Department of Justice has charged over 300 people for being involved in this. And so I do think more information is going to come out. But ultimately, I do think there needs to be more accountability from the Capitol Police. And we haven't seen, I don't think, real reform put in place there. We've seen money thrown at the problem, but we haven't actually addressed the root of the issue, which is how the one agency tasked with protecting Congress and the integrity of the Capitol couldn't do it on that day. And I think that's something that Congress ultimately has to look into, because the Capitol Police are accountable to and controlled by Congress.
Liz, what do you make of this?
You know, there's a bit of a contradiction in terms here, where if there are already congressional investigations going on, then why are the Republicans fighting this one so hard? It seems like if this is just another congressional investigation into the January 6th, I don't know what you want to call it, failed demonstration, insurrection, Instagram incident, whatever it was violent. It resulted in a lady being shot in the neck. And it resulted in quite a lot of people being, you know, I think quite sincerely afraid, frightened. So in that case, what's the big deal? If it's just another investigation, what are they so afraid of? I think the sheer amount of pushback indicates there's probably something there worth looking into. And I do think David is right that if there's any reason to believe these politicians were, let's say, involved in a particular political mood that Trump created that possessed them to participate in whipping up intention to participate in this ridiculous incident, then they need to be held accountable for that beyond just being voted out of office. They need to be held accountable for it in a particularly public way.
There are two separate, closely related problems that I think we're talking about here, though. One is the riot itself as a violent incident, and I think Rachel is right that this was a failure of security at the Capitol, and that's something that is being investigated and should be investigated. And the questions that the answers to questions about that, how do you stop people from overrunning the Capitol again, are basically questions about resources and strategy and policies, and I think that's fine. But the separate question is about the broader political significance of the riot, that it was an effort to subvert a democratic political process. It was an effort to stop the Congress from certifying the true election result that had happened, where Joe Biden had won an election by 7 million votes and won a clear majority in the Electoral College. It was an attempt to undermine our democracy. And so I think that is an important thing to look into, separate and apart from the question of, you know, how do you get people to actually be held back by barricades when there are inevitably future protests, future unrest at the Capitol. But I guess the question I have for David is, you know, you want to look at, you know, what former President Trump did, what Josh Hawley did, that sort of thing. What is a commission going to find out that we don't already know? I mean, as you note, this is basically a political question, but I think the key political facts appear to be out here, that you had irresponsible statements that certain people made and continue to make that have whipped people up, that have encouraged this sort of unrest and effort to subvert democracy. How does a commission tell us something new about that?
A commission has subpoena powers, and this has been a problem through the Trump years, as we saw it with Trump and his pals in Russia, that people were engaged in activities that were probably not exactly illegal. It's not illegal for the president of the United States to be communicating to radical people, come to Washington on a day and protest that I should not have to recognize the election. The statement, the president shouldn't have to recognize, that's free speech. The president talking to supporters, even if some of them are pretty out there, that's normal politics. The people on the president's campaign paying for buses for potentially violent people, none of that is illegal. But when you use subpoena powers to get an exact profile. Did money flow from the Trump campaign to the buses that brought the violent people to Congress? That's useful information. What we have here is an information problem. We need to fix in the public mind. And this is, I think, one of the things that's sort of disturbing about what Rachel said. This isn't politics. Politics is you campaign, you seek votes, you count votes. Once the result is there, you accept the result. That's politics. When you violently challenge the result, now we're outside politics. We don't vote putschists out of office. The problem is we already have voted the putschists out of office. That's why they made the putsch or attempted the putsch. This is not a comical incident. It's less deadly than many terrible things that have happened before, but this one was an incident that went to the very core of what it means to be a self-governing people. It was an attack on that project. And while we are going to send many people probably to prison for their particular violent acts, the people who organized it are going to go scot-free. At least what we can do is fix in the public mind who organized it, why, what they were trying to do, and that this is utterly, radically unacceptable, and comes attached with permanent disgrace.
Rachel, I'm wondering what you make of Liz's point that if there are already going to be congressional investigations, why are Republicans so resistant to this particular one? And when I look at this, I think what it is that this is a politically inconvenient matter for Republicans. It divides the Republican Party. It exposed Republican elected officials and Republican staff to real physical danger on the day that the riot happened. But you can't really you can't really be resolutely angry about the riot and the people in the party who fomented the riot, with the former president at the top of that, because of his ongoing role in the party. So isn't it basically just that Republicans wish they didn't have to talk about this anymore?
No, because I think they're going to continue to have to talk about it, regardless of whether this commission gets agreed to or not. These hearings are not going to stop. Democrats have made that very clear. But I think there's a fundamental distinction between, you know, Congress holding itself accountable, finding out what the problems were in their own security system, versus outsourcing that task to a number of people, you know, that aren't necessarily serving in government, aren't, you know, weren't involved in exactly what was going on and aren't accountable to it. And I also think there's a little bit of an imbalance that Republicans see here, because this was a terrible event. But to David's point, if we're going to look at who organized this, should we also be investigating if there was any sort of political radicalization from the left, you know, that resulted in a man open firing on Republicans in on a baseball field in a shooting that nearly killed Steve Scalise? Should we investigate whether or not Maxine Waters used her campaign funds to, you know, get on the ground and foment, what did she say, getting in people's faces right before a verdict in a jury trial? I think you open up, you know, a trend that is not going to go away, I guess is my point. And I think when you start to use the leverage of government to punish what is essentially, you know, politics gone wrong, I think you're moving into a new phase of self-government that I think a lot of people are going to be ultimately uncomfortable with.
Rachel's
questions don't go far enough. I mean, why don't we investigate the Pearl Harbor negligence at the same time, and who promoted Benedict Arnold? I mean, obviously, one way of heading off a question about President Trump's culpability is to open boxes about every other bad thing that has ever happened in the history of the world and say, let's get to President Trump after we solve all these other unrelated problems.
I want to move on and talk about the more productive aspect of what Congress has been up to this week, which is this bill, once called the Endless Frontier Act. We talked about this last week. It establishes a technology directorate at the National Science Foundation to beef up applied technology research. It supports the domestic microchip industry. Basically, the idea is that, you know, we're not doing enough on applied science in terms of research and investment, and this is a bipartisan priority that you have Republicans and Democrats agreeing. Let's spend a bunch of new money on this. Not as much new money as the bill originally envisioned. The bill's been watered down in certain ways, but it's a significant and bipartisan thing that, as we're taping on Friday, looks like it's about to happen. It's also being framed as a bill to compete with China. And I'm wondering, Rachel, to what extent is this really about China? I mean, I understand how more technology investment in some abstract way helps us compete with China, but it seems like that's not the primary reason to do more technology investment.
Well, that's to your point, how it's being framed, you know, and I'm glad to see, I think, the Senate acknowledging that there is a competitive threat from China and they're funding high tech research to that end. But I don't really think it gets at the scope of the problem nearly enough to the point that, you know, billions of dollars are going to be granted out through this bill to companies to do research in places like, you know, high tech physics and artificial intelligence. But these are multinational companies. They're based in America, but there's no restriction on them then taking that information and going to China. I think specifically of Google, who we fund to do AI research, who's also just opened an AI office in Beijing. So, you know, and you've also seen it kind of go through the sausage making process. There's a ton of additional projects in it that have nothing to do with China, including a $10 billion carve out for Amazon. So, you know, this is a first step to addressing what I think is a much larger problem, but this bill doesn't nearly address the scope.
David, do you agree with that? Is this a key part of a China strategy?
No. There's a book with a poignant title, The Last Pagans of Rome, which is about the people who still held to the old faith. And I feel like I want to write someday a book called The Last Free Traders of Washington. If the way to be competitive is to have low and rational rates of taxation, and then to trust the creativity of the American system of dynamism to create products and then to trade freely. And this idea that this is where I started my political career years and decades ago, saying the government is not a good investment banker. The investment bankers aren't so good either, but the government is worse. let the markets allocate capital, let the consumers dictate where it go, and then let's, I know this is kind of out of style idea, let's regard China as a potential partner and not a constant threat. Let's be mindful of their real weaknesses. This is something they do. It's not a good idea over there. It's not a good idea over here.
Liz, I hear that story about competition with China through free markets, and I think that did drive U.S. Policy toward China for a couple of decades. But, you know, this week we saw John Cena having to give this groveling apology on his movie junket for Fast and Furious 14 or whichever film this is in the franchise, because he said that Taiwan was a country, and he has to go out there and in Mandarin say, you know, I'm so sorry that I said this. And I think when we apply David's formula that you let companies compete in the open market, what you see is that the conditions that the Chinese impose for access to their market go in certain ways that are antithetical to American values, and companies that are just trying to make as much money as possible have no reason to prioritize American values of freedom and political rights and those sorts of things over being able to make money in the Chinese market.
What capital living vampire like on the blood of labor? You're kidding me. Yeah, no, I mean, that's not a big surprise. They don't care about, I mean, you know, capital itself, its purpose being to reap as much profit as it possibly can off the back of labor is completely value blind.
But labor doesn't care about this either, right? I mean, you see that in the NBA. You see both the team owners and the team players sort of working together to try to appease China as much as possible. I'm not sure labor power in the U.S. does much to help you here.
Yeah, I mean, labor can be good or bad, right? They can, you certainly see in certain contexts, labor banding together, as in general strikes for political reasons, anti-war, if you will, because the laborers are going to be the ones drafted into war. You do see labor having better politics than capital on certain fronts, but not necessarily in the case of trade. But I think that you can't rely on free trade to solve the problem of having an authoritarian dominant power in the world economy. I don't know if there is a very simple answer to that, except to, you know, try to build the strongest domestic economy you possibly can to buffer against having to give in to outside pressure. And part of that means accepting the possibility of not always choosing profit over values, which is, I know, quite foreign in the American mind.
Let's take a break. I will be back with Liz Brunig of The Atlantic, Rachel Bovard of the Conservative Partnership Institute, and our special guest, David Frum, to talk about Florida's new law on social media. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the right is Rachel Bovard, Senior Policy Director at the Conservative Partnership Institute. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, Staff Writer at The Atlantic. And our special guest is David Frum, Staff Writer at The Atlantic, author, and former speechwriter for former President George W. Bush. Tech industry groups are suing to block enforcement of a new Florida law signed by Governor Ron DeSantis that aims to limit technology companies' ability to censor, moderate, or algorithmically curate political content. The law is a reflection of conservative frustrations over social media platform policies, including their banishment of former President Trump. Among other provisions, the law would prevent platforms from banning candidates for state or local office from their platforms. It would also prohibit them from blocking content from journalistic enterprises. And it says companies are supposed to let users opt out of algorithms that determine what content is shown to them and how. Technology companies say the law violates their First Amendment right to choose what content they will and won't host. They also say it conflicts with federal law, the famous Section 230 of Communications Decency Act, which says tech companies can't be held liable for good faith decisions to remove, quote, obscene, lewd, lascivious, filthy, excessively violent, harassing, or otherwise objectionable content. Of course, the phrase otherwise objectionable contains multitudes. Rachel, what's the case for this law?
So What I think Ron DeSantis has done here is very instructive because, you know, while I think it's being framed as a response to conservative bias and all these things that, you know, ratchet up people's attention spans, he's made two really clear distinctions about what these platforms are that I think are important. And the first is, you know, that we constantly talk about these platforms as speech platforms, but what they really are digital ad agencies, and they're the biggest ones that exist in the world. And I think by, you know, bracketing this bill around political candidates, he's acknowledging the role that these platforms play in our political speech. And he's saying, look, it's an actual unfairness if you block one candidate and not another, you know, when they're trying to reach voters, because this is almost now a critical piece of infrastructure in reaching voters. The second thing I think it does is by allowing users the ability to appeal to these companies, to sue these companies in certain aspects, it gets at this notion that there isn't really any sort of claim users can bring against these companies right now. There's no transparency. There's no balance of relationship. So I think he's getting at two really key areas that I think are going to drive the debate, that are already driving the debate in Washington. And I think if there's more state action on this front, it's really going to be the tail that wags the dog in some respect, you know, pushing federal regulators to get engaged, lawmakers to get engaged in ways they currently haven't.
I want to hear from both Liz and David on this, because what Rachel laid out there, if we abstract it away from Donald Trump and from the specific complaints that we've been hearing from conservatives over the last few years about how they are treated by social media companies, this idea that basically you have powerful corporations that do too much to shape the way the public conversation happens, that you need government regulation to step in and ensure that that conversation is fair or complete or whatever your values are, that's something I would typically associate with the left rather than the right. And so, David, I'm sure that you oppose this law, and I'm interested to hear what you think the problem is with it. Liz, I'm interested in hearing from you about, do we need some sort of framework like this? Is this something that you should want from the left? And what do you do to ensure that it's actually achieving your goals rather than some other set of goals that some government bureaucrats or lawmakers who oversee it might achieve? So let's start with David and then Liz.
I don't even oppose it, because to oppose it would be to take the law more seriously than any of its authors do. It's not a law. It's a posture. It's a statement. Ron DeSantis's brilliant insight is that the Republican primary electorate wants a big culture war bully. And they got that in Donald Trump. But what he also understood is that leads only to failure in office and to defeat at re-election. So you have to find some way to pose as a big culture war bully while actually being a fairly conventional Bush-Romney Republican. And so that's his insight. That's what this law is. This law is unenforceable. It's obviously unconstitutional. It has no future as a matter of legislation. It's a big part of the Ron DeSantis story, the same way with this absurd idea that he's going to ban cruise lines from checking that passengers on cruise ships, a major vector of disease, are vaccinated. He's not going to win that fight. I don't think he wants to win that fight. He just wants to be seen fighting that fight to say to the primary electorate, I got all the attitude of Trump, but a little more brain.
Yeah, Liz, I think this is part of the issue when liberals have tried to come up with these sorts of regimes, is that you have all of these enforcement issues that David describes there. So it's not clear, even if you think that some sort of regime is necessary like this, that you can actually put it in and make it work.
Yeah, I don't have an answer here. I don't have a solution, that is to say. But I do think that the problem is very clear, and that's, in a liberal democracy, you need fair elections that are accessible to, you know, every qualified candidate. What we have is a private, electioneering apparatus, in that the way that elections are carried out is through these private companies, more or less, that have rules that largely exclude regulation by the United States, by the people. So fairness essentially goes out the window, and there's no way for the public to oversee how the elections are managed in that respect. And I think that's a pretty serious, pretty glaring conflict that we got by with not dealing with for a long time because the technology just wasn't readily available. But now that it is, and it's playing an increasingly important role in our daily lives, I think it's something that's going to have to be dealt with at some point. I don't know how, but I see the conflict, and I think it's serious.
Rachel, is David right that this law is basically stage fighting? I mean, in addition to the what I think are significant constitutional issues, significant issues of preemption by federal law, also a lot of the stuff in terms of how you would actually implement some of the rules around how algorithms can and can't work, I think are impractical. Is the intention for this law to be enforced?
So I almost think success isn't really the point. And what I mean by that is, you know, think about the last time the federal government took a big swing at these tech companies. It was in 2018 with the passage of FOSTA-SESTA, which was getting at the sex trafficking problem, where these companies were using Section 230 as a shield to protect them from having to do anything about the sex trafficking of minors on their platform. Backpage.com was the big antagonist of this. Now, that was pushed into action by laws similar to what Ron DeSantis just passed. You know, states were pushing toward this idea, constantly getting struck down. State after state would pass a law, it would be struck down on preemption grounds, but it finally put enough groundswell support into the federal government actually doing something about this problem. Same thing happened with why the Department of Justice actually finally sued Google under our antitrust laws. It wasn't DOJ that initiated that suit. It was 50 state attorneys general. So I do think there's a broader strategic imperative for the states, and I think they are responding to real and legitimate concerns that, you know, you can say are grievance politics to some extent on the right, but I think are actually, to Liz's point, much more, I think, of a response to this really structural problem we now have with social media having, you know, and these companies more broadly having multi-sector control over massive parts of our economy with, you know, no user appeal and zero accountability. And they're very much changing the nature of our politics. So I think it's rooted in that, but I ultimately don't think success is necessarily the point. It's the beginning of, I think, a broader strategic end game that is going to push Congress.
Can you walk us through a little bit what that end game would entail? Because I can buy the idea that this is part of a political strategy towards some federal legislative or regulatory end, but how would those regulations actually work? I mean, is there a way that is consistent with the First Amendment to get what conservatives seem to want here, which is basically like, don't push Donald Trump off of the platform and don't have algorithms that, you know, have real or perceived effects that reduce our reach on these platforms? Aren't the companies right that they have a significant First Amendment right here to determine for themselves what kind of content they want to be in the business of showing people?
Well, I think there's a number of ways to get at it. I mean, think about already these platforms. Of course, they have First Amendment rights, but they're incredibly privileged First Amendment actors, more so than almost any other First Amendment actor in our society. You know, Section 230 gives them a bulletproof liability shield for any content. That doesn't really exist anywhere else. I mean, sure, you have newspaper comment sections that benefit from it, but that's not really the issue that Congress wants to address. So I think more broadly, there's a number of proposals to get at this problem. You even saw Justice Clarence Thomas opine recently on one of them, which is common carriage rules, which are, you know, a centuries-old common law tradition that has been implemented many times when our societies encounter technologies that begin to change how we live together. We've said, well, there is a social good in having access to these platforms, and as a result, they have to serve all comers, you know, and the government gives them certain privileges because of that. There's also, you know, Section 230 reform, which is getting a lot of attention in Congress about, you know, what they can hold on their platforms and the benefit they receive for it. So I think there's a number of ways you can actually get at this problem on the algorithmic side as well, making that not Section 230 protected because it is inherently editorial content from these companies. You know, they're not simply, they're the ones deciding, right? So they can do it, but it's not subject to Section 230 protection. So there is a fairly robust debate going on in Congress. They just haven't agreed on anything. And I think the states really want to push them in that direction. So I think any of those proposals could be ripe for discussion in the next 5 years.
David, what do you make of that? Do you buy this theory that even if this law is sort of a fight for show, that they're it's leading up towards some sort of federal thing that could be substantive?
I just think you're solving the wrong problem. Supposing I came to you in 1995 and said, look, we're going to have this amazing new technology. It's going to allow you to instantly communicate with anybody else on Earth, share your ideas, share your values. There's one price, which is that you have to pay for it with the return of measles. What? How is that possible? The biggest problem with social media is not that Donald Trump doesn't get to incite race hatred on somebody else's platform. The biggest problem is not that Ben Shapiro gets only 8 of the top 10 stories on Facebook instead of all 10. The biggest problem is a flow of radical disinformation, especially medical disinformation, that has huge measurable impacts on human health. So the problem the conservatives want to solve is purely a self-interested one. And it doesn't deal with the biggest problem on these platforms, which is that they become ways to weaponize disinformation. And we are all seeing in the medical context how lethal that misinformation can be.
But I mean, is there anything to do about that from a public policy perspective? I mean, the people talk about that, you know, you have this sort of content and the algorithms promote it, but you have lots of places, lots of communities where WhatsApp is the primary vector for sharing that sort of medical information, and that's not algorithmic at all. So I don't, you know, the people have said nonsense to each other since the dawn of time. I don't know that there's anything that the government really, that we can expect that the government will do about that.
Here's what you can do, but again, it's a different kind of solution. What Ron DeSantis and the others want to do is they want to have some way of controlling what the most powerful media companies on earth do without building a bigger state. So they want to create private rights of action. They want to create litigation, and that's obviously unworkable. And it's just obviously intended to bully frighten the companies into being nicer to Donald Trump and Ben Shapiro. If you want to control these giant entities, you need to build an equivalently powerful regulatory apparatus. That's what happened when radio came along, and not so much in the United States, but in countries like Britain and Canada. They built radio networks, and they built then these giant radio and later television regulatory authorities. The United States didn't take that path. But if you have power, you can only check it with equal power, and that means big, intrusive regulatory state. And if the conservatives don't want to do that, then they're just trying to browbeat the companies into being nicer to their favorites.
Liz, what's your preferred course of action here?
You know, I think it's hard to say. I mean, it is a serious question as to what to do about people being wrong about everything and sort of counter-enlightenment by nature. I have no clue what to do about that. I think, you know, the internet is just a vector by which people can sort of lustily and vigorously be wrong and encourage each other to sin and whatever. But I think that's something they managed to do even without the privilege of doing it really quickly online, which isn't to understate the problem. It's a real problem. But I do think it is worth singling out the election issue because it is, I think, a real quandary for a liberal democracy that on the one hand values freedom of speech, and free and fair and accessible and transparent elections, but on the other hand has decided to prioritize a sort of libertarian freedom and autonomy for capital. And I think it's one of those places where those two things are quite clearly getting to a point of pretty robust conflict. So I think that's something that we'll have to sort out eventually.
I have one related matter I want to ask about before we leave this topic, because Rachel, I David is saying here conservatives want to do this without a more robust state, but I know you at least in one key area have proposed a more robust state, which is that you wrote a column this week saying that Amazon may not run afoul of our antitrust regime as it stands now, but our antitrust regime should be stopping companies like Amazon from having too much power by, for example, you note the acquisition of the MGM film studio. But Amazon is still going to have a really small market share in entertainment, which is a reasonably fragmented industry in which Amazon is not the largest player. So what would an antitrust regime look like that looks at a company like Amazon that isn't dominant in most of the businesses that it's in and is in a wide variety of often pretty unrelated businesses? They own Whole Foods in addition to all these other things. So what is a quantitative measure that looks at Amazon and isn't just conservatives saying, I don't like all this power Bezos has? How would you define a rule such that Amazon is an antitrust violator?
So I'm going to get to this a little bit later in my rant, actually, but I think there's a key distinction that needs to be made, and that is between regulation and law enforcement. So everything that I propose, contra what David suggested, does not require a regulatory morass. Section 230 is governed by Congress. It is our laws, our lawmakers making laws, and that exists without a regulatory apparatus. The same is also true for common carriage under Title II. You know, FCC already does this for a number of industries. It already exists. It's going to simply be, you know, existing law being applied. Now, when it comes to antitrust, you know, oftentimes, I think, on the right, there's a conflation between antitrust and regulation when one is law enforcement and the other is not. And I would argue that robust antitrust enforcement is actually the antidote to a regulatory morass, because if you have robust antitrust enforcement, you necessarily do not need a big regulatory state. You're solving the problem. Now, I do think, and I wrote in that column, that Amazon's acquisition of MGM doesn't trip up our antitrust laws, because as you point out, I do think that our streaming markets are fairly robust and competitive. But I think there is a question that over the last 30 years or 40 years or so, we have not aggressively enforced on this. We've allowed massive corporate concentration, in a lot of these markets such that two or three players dominate. And I do think that that has had consequential effects for our markets. And I think when you have technology companies in particular that control not only speech markets, but are huge market access points for millions of small businesses, as Amazon is, that is a question. And so if our regulators and our antitrust enforcers have been tying themselves, to a higher standard than exists in law, or tying their hands in some way, then Congress needs to make clear what it meant by those antitrust laws. And that is what I've written on in a number of cases, and I think should happen.
Just speaking as a former lawyer, there are two ways you enforce these things. One is private rights of action. Three, private rights of action, government enforcement, and regulation.
Private right of action means some private person brings a lawsuit.
Right. Or the government can bring a lawsuit. And those are incredibly slow and was not very effective. If you really want to stand up to these companies, if you really want to do that and not just browbeat them into favoring your favorites, you need a regulatory regime as powerful and present as those companies themselves.
Let's take a break. I've been talking with Liz Brunig of The Atlantic, Rachel Bovard of the Conservative Partnership Institute, and our special guest, David Frum. We will be back to talk about a state-sponsored hijacking. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rachel Bovard, Senior Policy Director at the Conservative Partnership Institute. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. And our special guest is David Frum, also a staff writer at The Atlantic, an author, and a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Last weekend, the government of Belarus hijacked a Ryanair flight from Greece to Lithuania. I'm not exaggerating when I call this a hijacking. Belarus faked a security incident, intercepted the plane with a fighter jet, and forced it to land at Minsk instead of Vilnius. They did this because a journalist critical of Belarus's authoritarian government was on board the plane. They arrested him and his girlfriend, and 7 hours later, they let the plane with most of its passengers get on its way. European and American political leaders have responded with outrage. EU authorities instructed airlines not to fly over Belarus and banned Belarus's national airline, Belavia, from flying into the EU. But Russia has been sticking up for Belarus and pushing back on the airspace restrictions. In some cases, Russia has been denying Western airlines permission to fly over Russia on routes that are designed to avoid Belarus. So I look at this incident, and I look at a number of other things that have happened in the last few years. The killing of Jamal Khashoggi, the assassinations that the Russian government has carried out on European countries' soil, all of the stuff that we talked about earlier with China making John Cena grovel before them and controlling effectively the speech of Western corporations to align with the prerogatives of the Chinese regime. What do we do about this? I feel like we just look hapless in response. And I think part of that is a structural disadvantage that we have with the way our regimes work, that it's harder for us to marshal corporate and government and popular responses to these things. But I just, the idea that the response is to ban their airline from landing at EU airports, it just feels weak to me. So what do we do here?
I think we disaggregate the problems. The China case is a special and difficult one because the Chinese state is so strong. The Chinese society and economy are so rich and powerful that there's a limit to our ability to enforce norms on them. Saudi Arabia and Russia are very different matters. I mean, the thing about the Russian behavior that is so remarkable is one, how incredibly reckless it is. I mean, as you say, carrying out assassinations in the UK, and not just any kind of assassination, but using prohibited radioactive material and prohibited nerve agents to do it, that's a special show of contempt from a society with a GDP about the size of Italy. And in the Saudi case, we're dealing with an American client state, and it's murdering and dismembering an American green card holder. So there are places where American power can be brought to bear, and then we need to understand there are places where American power is going to be less effective. China is troubling. The United States, you have to go back to the early years of the 20th century to find a time when the United States confronted a power that was both economically competent and militarily competent at the same time. The Soviet Union was never economically competent. Nazi Germany was never economically competent. You have to go back to the Kaiser, maybe to the British Empire. So it's a new kind of problem that we're going to have to wrap our minds around in ways that 19th century Americans can guide us. But Russia and Saudi Arabia, no putting up with that.
Liz, something that Matt Iglesias has been writing about a number of these issues is that a lot of more dovish people on the left are reluctant to get too worked up about some of these things, especially the China stuff, because it feels like a justification for a military buildup or a new Cold War. And what he says basically is that if you really want to avoid a new Cold War, and he really wants to avoid a new Cold War, you can't ignore these problems. You have to take them seriously and come up with solutions for them that are not military solutions. That makes sense to me. But then I look at this and the military solutions here are very unappealing, but so are the non-military solutions. What do we do?
Right. I don't think there are military or non-military solutions to a lot of these problems. There are attitudinal solutions to some of them. Insofar as Russia is putting its pipeline through Germany, for example, this new gas pipeline, and there are no sanctions being placed, what a novel idea. No sanctions. Leave them alone. Let them get on with life. That seems like a fairly good idea to me. And I happen to feel that way a lot. With Saudi Arabia, a lot of their nonsense ends up being our problem precisely because they are a U.S. client state. That seems like a fairly easy problem to solve by them no longer being a U.S. client state, right? We can just work with other states, and then their endless human rights abuses are not on our conscience. We can't police the world and make sure that every state is acting in accordance with American norms, but we can certainly do business with ones that do. And I tend to think that those kinds of adjustments are much easier to make than either military or non-military adjustments to other nations' behaviors.
Rachel, Liz alludes there to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is a nearly completed gas pipeline under the Baltic Sea from Russia to Germany. And the reason that this is of concern to Americans, why we would talk about this pipeline, is that it's been U.S. policy to oppose this project for a long time, the reason being that once Russia has a direct route to get gas into Germany without going through countries of Eastern Europe, that increases Russia's ability to put the screws to those countries by cutting off their supplies of gas. Basically, this pipeline, the risk is that it will strengthen Russia's hand within Europe. Liz says, go ahead, let them open the pipeline. I've been frustrated that the Biden administration, unlike the Trump administration, has decided not to stand in the way of this because of the way that strengthens Russia's hand in Europe. But on the other hand, that's the Germans really want this pipeline. The Biden administration correctly says that not blocking the pipeline is a way to foster good relations with Germany. I don't know how we make Europe want to be protected from Russian influence by our own actions across the Atlantic. But I still look at that with frustration. I see Russia, it's not just about Russia mistreating its own citizens. Liz notes we can let other countries be the way they are, but it's about giving Russia more power to harass the citizens of other countries, or to help its client states harass the citizens of other their own countries, as we saw with the Belarus hijacking, and to harass the citizens of all the other countries that had passengers on that flight.
Yeah, I distinguish a little bit here between China and Russia in this regard, because I think China is a massive economic power across many fronts, and their strategy is a geoeconomic one, and I think we need to confront them on their own terms in that. But with Russia, so much of Russia's power is as a petrostate. So these pipelines are the one source of leverage, you know, that actually means something to them in a meaningful way. And to your point, I think, you know, the ability of putting Nord Stream 2 to avoid Ukraine entirely gives Russia the power to expand its influence in the region, to encircle Ukraine. And, you know, I do find a certain amount of irony in the fact that, you know, so-called Russian agent Donald Trump actually fought this pipeline throughout his presidency, and Biden has reversed course, which I think is actually upending the promise that Tony Blinken made to the Senate in his confirmation hearing, Secretary of State, saying, "Look, we're going to continue sanctions on this pipeline." They're reversing it, and I do think this is a repeat of the Obama era concessions for concessions strategy that has failed, that doesn't work with an authoritarian like Vladimir Putin, and I think is just going to, as you point out, increase the leverage Russia has over Europe. And at some point, Europe has to stand up in its own defense, and it's clear that they're not willing to do that.
David, is Rachel right there? Is this an area where Donald Trump was tougher on Russia than Joe Biden?
The Trump administration was very anxious about promoting American gas exports to Europe. Donald Trump had a series of people he was beholden to, and he certainly had obviously obligations to Russia and protected them from a lot of things. But when he saw an opportunity to promote American liquid natural gas exports, that was also a group of people he was beholden to. I think the Biden people want to rebuild the relationship with Germany that was so damaged during the Trump years. And right now, I think we're also a little aghast. The real victim of the Nord Stream pipeline is Poland. That's the country that the Russians are trying to isolate from an energy point of view. That ordinarily your pipeline to Germany would flow across Poland, and this allows the Russians to turn off their gas to Poland without turning off the gas to Germany and taking that risk. But Poland has also become an increasingly bad actor in recent years. So one of the other differences is I think Donald Trump had more sympathy for that, for the current authoritarian trending regime in Poland than the Biden people do. And they also may need a little dose of reality.
I don't care for the governing party in Poland, but it feels to me like that's exactly the wrong way of thinking there, that because you have this government that hasn't been committed to an independent judiciary or various other things in Poland, that would reorient your view on the importance of protecting Eastern Europe from Russian domination. That feels short-sighted to me.
I agree with that, and I would still be anti-Nord Stream 2 if it were entirely up to me. But I think you can also understand that Biden people have a very particular problem with getting the German relationship right again after so much harm was done to it over the past 4 years.
Liz, one idea that Matt Iglesias had in that column that I mentioned, and this is to go back to China for a second, is that our tools are limited here because of that power, the extreme economic and military power of the Chinese regime that we described there. Mm-hmm. But why not at least bring film executives before Congress and try to make them talk about China? You have a policy at Apple that they won't make content that is critical of China. And you don't see this as an explicitly stated policy at other film studios, but there is this conspicuous lack of films and TV shows with Chinese communist villains of the sort that you saw during the Cold War with Soviet figures. Why not at least bring them before Congress, embarrass them a little bit, try to make them talk about these issues and try to make them talk about Hong Kong or Tibet or Xinjiang? At least we could use the hearings power, even if we don't have anything else we can do.
Hey, I'm on board with that. If somebody wants to humiliate extremely rich and powerful people, I'm on board. I'll ask the questions. I mean, I think it's very, you know, we all know the reasons. And I do think it's conspicuous how many of our contemporaneous villains, say, line up along the Al-Qaeda or ISIS side of things, or even the Russian side of things versus the Chinese side of things. You hardly see any of that. And, you know, it's because it would screw up things in the Chinese markets. I also think it's the case, and while we're asking questions of Hollywood execs, that in blockbuster movies that need to do well in the Chinese markets to really make back what was spent on them. You see Hollywood executives not wanting to put in the kind of socially liberal material that they really believe in, because that doesn't fly in Chinese markets. This was the case, I think, quite notably with the Star Wars movies and a planned potential romance plot between a couple of male characters, which was eventually killed. And I've heard rumors of similar choices in other major blockbusters. So I would definitely like to hear about those kinds of decisions being made, because I think if those are the calculations unfolding, people deserve to hear about it. And I think that really puts the true intentions and true values of these filmmakers in a sharp focus.
In this environment, we're looking forward to, in June, Joe Biden's going to be going over to Europe for a lot of high-profile meetings, some related to NATO. He will also be meeting Vladimir Putin face-to-face in Geneva on June 16th. Rachel, what would you be looking for the Biden administration to put on their agenda for that meeting?
Well, I think, you know, strength begets strength to some extent. I don't think this concessions for concessions strategy has worked from the Obama administration. I would be disappointed if Joe Biden continues it. And I do think he's going to have to account for, you know, going back to the Nord Stream 2 issue, how incoherent some of these policies actually are. Because when you look at the actual sanctions on Nord Stream 2, Biden decided to sanction the ships involved in building the pipeline, but not the actual company and its CEO, Matthias Warnig, who is a known Putin crony and a former East German intelligence agent. So I think, you know, that tells Putin he has a little bit more of a free hand here if the Biden administration is not going to sanction his cronies and invoke this sort of incoherent approach to this pipeline. I think he has more of an open hand than you know, he previously thought. So I think we're going to be looking for a little bit more of an aggressive posture from the Biden administration on Russia. That's what I'll be looking for anyway.
We have reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. David Frum, what's on your mind?
There has been much discussion in recent days about the reviving strength or popularity of the lab escape theory of the virus that has swept the world. The idea that this somehow originated in a lab accident rather than in the bad practices in Chinese food markets. Either way, we are confronting the costs of Chinese bad practices, whichever theory is true. But people who are trying to use this theory to incite a new culture war at home or a new Cold War with China are missing the point. If China can upend the world this way, it proves that we need more international cooperation, more supervision of Chinese institutions, more cooperation. And by the way, that will mean also that the United States agree to submit itself to those same international institutions. This is a smaller planet than we ever imagined before. We have to act that way.
Liz Brunig, it's your soapbox.
I'd like to take my opportunity to rant this week in a little bit of a melancholy direction. Earlier this week, the children's book artist Eric Carle passed away. You know him as the author of The Very Hungry Caterpillar, as well as dozens of other beloved children's books. He was a fantastic author for a lot of reasons, but I think the number one reason that my kids and I love him is that he saw the world the way that children see it, as beautiful, as alive, everything full of meaning, even when it's broken or ugly, riddled with holes, for instance, caterpillar feeling a little sick and looking really weird right before it turns into something special and beautiful. I think children very much relate with the feeling of being on an odd kind of journey that's going to end up somewhere wonderful, and I do too.
Rachel Bovard, what's your rant?
On Wednesday, Amazon announced it was purchasing MGM Studios. And while this merger is likely to be approved by the DOJ, the question of market concentration is separate from the issue of one company or a handful of companies owning multiple avenues of expression in the public square. Amazon's already the dominant player in the retail book market, so what it chooses to sell, or in recent cases, to drop from its shelves, can alter the market for what books even make it to print. Amazon Web Services hosts massive sections of the internet, and Jeff Bezos himself owns the Washington Post. As single companies come to dominate avenues for expression, the terms of our public square begin to subtly change from hosting diverse voices to the antiseptic sameness of a solely owned company town. More of us in culture and politics should pay attention to this trend, particularly coming out of COVID, where small businesses have been crushed and the mega firms have only gotten bigger.
For my rant, people sometimes accuse me of being a contrarian, and this often comes up when I am saying things that are actually majoritarian views. I mean, for example, I wrote a piece a few years ago about how I love mayonnaise, and you also love mayonnaise. That's why it's the best-selling condiment in America every year. It's in half of the foods you eat. I was for Joe Biden in the 2020 presidential primary, which not a lot of people in the media and political class were, but obviously that was not a contrarian position. But I want to talk about an area where I am truly a contrarian. As we go into Memorial Day weekend and the summer cooking season, I hate grilling. I think grilling is such a bad way to cook. Your grill is filthy. You cook on a grill that's in a condition that you would never let your indoor cookware get to. It's because the high temperature of the grill burns food onto the grates. It's impossible to get off, and people lie to themselves and say that scraping the grill down with a brush constitutes cleaning it. The grill also has its heating element below the food, which is stupid because it means that fat and other things fall from the grates into the heating element and flare up and cause more of a mess to happen, and it'll burn your marinade on your chicken. Indoors is like the peak of human civilization. We have this great cooking equipment in our kitchens that has temperature control that you don't get from a grill, that allows you to get reliable, consistent results in a way that you don't when you burn things on the grill. And in fact, maybe my position isn't contrarian, because people talk about how they love grilling, but in fact, what's your revealed preference? Where do you do almost all of your cooking? You do it indoors, because indoor cooking is better than grilling. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Liz Brunig, Rachel Bovard, and David Frum. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay and recorded and mixed by Desmond Taylor. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.